This is Wellness Rising, coming together to prevent and manage diabetes. Produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by a grant from the Medtronic Foundation, committed to improving health outcomes across the globe. Hello and welcome. I'm Roy Taylor, a radio host who does shows about Native issues. Today's special is called Wellness Rising, coming together to prevent and manage diabetes. Through the hour, you will hear from many Native people who help people with diabetes or who have diabetes. I'm one of them. I was diagnosed about a year ago, and now I'm learning how to manage it. I'm in good company. More than 7,500 Native Americans in Minnesota are estimated to have diabetes. Reporter Leah Lim met with some of them a few weeks ago.
Little Earth is an American Indian preference housing community in the Phillips neighborhood of Minneapolis. It has youth, community, drug and sobriety programs, and I had the honor of attending Elders Bingo.
How long does the bingo go on?
We're done by noon.
After I was introduced to the group and they found out I was looking to speak to those with diabetes, many voices answered that they either had diabetes or knew people who had diabetes.
Oh, okay. My brother does. And he's handsome, too.
I spoke with several people in the room, including Sandria Mason.
I'm borderline diabetic, and I have one of my sons has diabetes, and four or five of my grandchildren have diabetes.
Sandria is borderline diabetic, also known as pre-diabetic, and took the opportunity to educate herself and learned a few tricks to build a healthier diet.
But yeah, I went to a group at the Indian Health Board for borderline, and they showed us how to cook meals and different things to eat. And instead of drinking pap, drink sparkling water, all different flavors. I really liked that. And they had some good things, and they had some stuff I didn't care for. But it was nice.
The journey for Sandria continues with her adult son as well. And with that, she has this advice.
I just wish they knew that they do need to go to the doctor. They need to take their medications. You know, like my son, as soon as he starts feeling good, he stops taking them. And then he notices something's going wrong. He gets, he cuts himself on the lower part of his leg and he ends up with a big sore. You know what? I said, if you just take your pill, that may not happen.
I also met Mark Flores at Little Earth. He's just moved to Minnesota from Georgia.
Well, I had diabetes for about maybe 10 years, and I have type 2, but I do take injections. But right now my A1C is 7.2, so it's gotten better.
A1C is a common blood test that indicates the average blood sugar level of a patient for the previous 2 to 3 months. The higher the number, the greater the risk of diabetes complications. Individuals may have different goals for their A1C levels, but a score at or below 7 is a common target. A year ago, Mark's A1C was at about 11 points. He has since gotten his A1C under control, but struggles with diet when trying to maintain his A1C levels.
But right now I'm having problems with a diet.
Mark is waiting to get on medical assistance and is having a hard time getting balanced meals. He lives by himself and reports that he can't cook.
But the thing is that there's other resources that I do need as far as meals on wheels, so I can get these balanced meals that I could have. Transportation is another thing I'm not able to get around, so I'm pretty much stay-at-home type guy. You know, I don't do any exercises because I can't go anywhere. So that's another thing. It's hard to keep my blood sugar at a point where I want to keep it.
When asked if he had any advice, he responded that raising awareness is valuable.
Well, I'm thinking education is one thing that is helpful. You know, what you're doing exactly, you know, is getting awareness, you know.
People come from tribal communities around Minnesota and the United States, and Rose helps connect them to cultural resources.
Some don't have Anishinaabe names, Indian names.
I connect them with different people, tell them what they need to do basically to receive their new name, like make a gift or get a gift and pass tobacco.
Like many at Bingo, Rose has also been diagnosed with diabetes.
I found out I was diabetic about maybe almost 2 years ago. And at first, I didn't really take it serious. At the time, I think I was 36. And I was like, oh, I'm 36. That's something, not something someone my age could get. I was more tired, and there was times I'd get shaky and real dizzy. And then I went to the doctors, and they said my A1C was at a 9.6. And I guess that's extremely high. So they started me on metformin, and I take 1,000 milligrams twice a day. And they started me out with insulin as well. So I have to take a shot every night in the stomach.
Rose's mother passed away in 2017, and Rose stopped eating. Since then, she has been dealing with tragedy, and maintenance of her diet has been difficult.
Hopefully I'll be able to, I don't know, maintain it more. My husband, I mean, I was eating right, and at one point he was making it where, like, they would eat, like, really good meals, and I'd have baked chicken and plain brown rice while they were eating burgers and french fries, and I'm like, hey, it's not fair, but I guess I have to change and if I want to be here around long enough for my kids and my grandkids. Just get checked and be aware. Like, it's for any age, and it doesn't discriminate on age or race.
I'm Leah Lem.
As you just heard, it takes some adjusting when you hear you have diabetes. And I can attest it helps when you understand how the disease works. Producer Melissa Townsend sat down with two medical doctors who practice in northern Minnesota. Here's that report.
My name is Mary Owen. I'm from the Tlingit Nation of Southeast Alaska. I'm the director of Center of American Indian Minority Health within the University of Minnesota Medical School Duluth campus. And I am a family doc and have been practicing serving Native people for about 15 years.
So what are you seeing at the clinic where you work?
Diabetes is somewhat of a silent predator. And usually people will come in because they're having some sort of symptoms. For instance, they notice that they're gaining a lot of weight. You can do that with type 2 diabetes. They might be having to pee a lot more, might be a lot more hungry or thirsty, or just what I've noticed is that people come in when they're feeling terrible and they don't know why.
These patients with diabetes feel terrible because the cells in their bodies can't absorb the sugar or glucose they need to work right. Cells need insulin to absorb sugar. And in a healthy body, our cells call for sugar and the pancreas creates the insulin so the cell can absorb it. But a body with diabetes becomes resistant to the insulin and the cells can't absorb the sugar.
We know diabetes comes from your insulin not being able to respond well enough to get the sugar out of the bloodstream.
So the cells are starving for glucose. At the same time that there is way too much glucose circulating in the bloodstream. To diagnose diabetes, Dr. Owen starts with a fasting blood glucose test.
All it is a marker of blood sugar.
After no food for 8 hours, a healthy person's blood glucose is below 100.
From 100 to 126 is considered pre-diabetes range.
Pre-diabetes means you are at risk of developing the disease if you don't eat healthier foods and get more active.
So if you over-challenge your pancreas and the cells that release the insulin, you're going to get to that 126 and above. That's when diabetes kicks in.
Type 2 diabetes is on the rise around the globe. In the U.S., the number of people diagnosed with diabetes more than doubled in the last 20 years, according to the Center for Disease Control. And experts estimate there are millions of people who have the disease but who have not been diagnosed. American Indians are disproportionately affected by the disease. Dr. Arnie Vineo is also a family physician. He is Ojibwe from the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe. He works at the clinic on the reservation. He says when it's unmanaged, diabetes can shorten someone's life by 10 to 15 years. And that's a huge loss.
We respect our elders. We revere our elders. And we need them. And, you know, if we're 10 years less, you know, we're losing libraries. We're losing our language. We're losing our traditions.
Dr. Vanio says diabetes can damage every part of the body.
Eye disease, heart disease, kidney disease, strokes. The risk for somebody that has diabetes, and especially if it's not well controlled, they have 2 to 4 times the risk for having heart disease, a heart attack, or a stroke than somebody without diabetes. And when your sugars are up, your immune system doesn't work like it's supposed to. Nothing works like it's supposed to when your sugars are high.
Over time, all that sugar in the bloodstream damages your blood vessels. That's why many people with diabetes have foot pain or impaired vision.
Blood vessels go everywhere in your body. We have about 160 blood vessels that are big enough to have names, aorta, carotid, subclavians, all that stuff. But then they branch smaller and smaller and smaller.
All the way down to tiny capillaries in your toes. And those help the nerves in the feet work right.
And if those blood vessels aren't supplying a good blood supply to the nerves, then the nerves get damaged. It's like those nerves, they can't work like they're supposed to. And, you know, so they can't provide sensation like they're supposed to. So they kind of like make up a signal. So people get this burning pain in their feet or they don't feel things. When I was a resident in Seattle in 1994 or so, I had a patient with diabetes out of control for a long time, working as a carpenter, and he stepped on a roofing nail. He had a nail in his foot through his boot all day long and didn't know it. And he almost lost his foot. And, you know, that's such a simple thing. I mean, who wouldn't feel a nail in their foot? But he couldn't. And yet he had this burning signal in his feet all the time, you know, from those damaged nerves.
Dr. Vanio says the same is true for our eyes. The nerves in there get damaged, and that makes diabetes one of the leading causes of blindness in developed countries.
The back of your eye is just a network of, it's the only place you can see blood vessels in your body. So it's pretty cool, you know, to take an ophthalmoscope and actually look in somebody's eyes because you can see the blood vessels back there. Sometimes you can see the damage in there.
Because American Indians have the highest rates of diabetes among any racial group in the country, some people believe natives are predisposed to the disease. Dr. Mary Owen sets the record straight.
As far as I'm aware, we've never been shown to have any genetic predisposition. What we do know is that our population was started on these commodity foods and other foods that totally transformed our diet very rapidly, on a massive scale, because all of a sudden we were poor and didn't have food, and the government agreed to provide some so that we could stay alive. And that rapid change, I think, was a setup. Maybe there's something like epigenetics as well involved.
Epigenetics is the study of how life experiences are passed down physiologically from one generation to the next.
I do believe it comes back to a rapid change in our status and our diet. I don't know. What do you think, Dr. Vanio?
I would have to agree with that. You know, back when we were gathering our own wild rice and fish and moving camps to different places, you know, we didn't have the same thing. We didn't have refined sugar and all the, boy, it doesn't seem like it, in an hour interview, historical trauma would come up.
Exactly.
But, you know, but that's a big part of
exactly.
Who we are.
That was one of my questions.
You know, there is a lot of past history, badness that has happened over the, you know, over the generations. You know, loss of generations of parents and all the traditions and things that went with those things. And it's part of a different conversation, but also a part of this conversation.
How trauma affects your makeup.
Right, or susceptibility to disease.
The trauma of the Native American genocide in the United States could make Native people more susceptible to disease. But this has not been proven. And Dr. Owen and Dr. Vanio want to make sure Native people do not think the disease is inevitable. It is not inevitable.
It's always dependent upon that individual. None of this is necessitated, and that's the key of this show, that we don't have to have diabetes.
This is Wellness Rising, coming together to prevent and manage diabetes. Made possible by a grant from the Medtronic Foundation, committed to improving health outcomes across the globe. As you just heard, healthcare professionals have been working hard to help people with diabetes realize how much control they can have over the disease. But generic approaches haven't been very effective. What works better is involving the community. Reporter Leah Lim spoke with Stacey Hammer, a registered dietitian and the diabetes coordinator at the Lower Sioux Healthcare Center.
She works with individuals of all ages and does education around nutrition-related conditions, including diabetes. Stacey recalls conversations had during her nutrition education around statistics and Native health.
Well, whenever they talked about health disparities, Native Americans were always brought up. And so it was always a disparity. It was always having the highest rate of diabetes, of heart disease, you know, all these different things. And I thought, boy, they really paint a really bleak picture for, you know, Native people.
Over the 5 years in her position at the Lower Sioux Healthcare Center, Stacey has noticed an uptick in people coming to her for healthy eating advice. But she also finds herself reminding the older population that it's not too late to make a change, and that those changes can affect more than just their health.
And especially with like our older population and that are raising their grandchildren, a lot of times I'll just hear, well, I'm too old, it doesn't matter anymore, you know. But I always remind them, too, that, you know, you want to be around for your grandchildren, you want to be healthy. And you have grandchildren living in your home, they're watching what you're eating, you're bringing home the food. So adopting these healthier habits are something for the whole family.
Stacey works to improve the health outcomes of those she serves and also educate in a culturally appropriate way. She continues to host Diabetes Bingo, which integrates Dakota imagery into the bingo cards. Before bingo begins, she creates a meal and holds a lesson on healthy eating. Even the prizes are kitchen-related.
You know, glass bowls with lids and certain things that they can utilize in the kitchen for cooking, because I'm always encouraging people to start cooking more at home rather than going out to eat and getting fast food or purchasing things in the grocery store that are processed and boxed up.
Stacey also shared with me a visual guide for people to follow that combines Dakota culture and the USDA recommended food guidelines. The original My Plate, which is the updated version of the food pyramid, looks like a meal place setting and incorporates USDA food pattern recommendations by splitting up a plate into sections for vegetables, fruit, protein, and grains with dairy on the side. It's meant to serve as a healthy eating reminder.
I worked with two of our Dakota language teachers along with our graphic design department at our casino, and we put together a My Dakota plate, and we put Dakota language into it. And so we had a sample plate of what our indigenous foods look like.
Looking at the front of My Dakota plate, there's the usual circle split into four sections with a drink to the side. But on this plate, there is corn, squash, buffalo steak, berries, and chokecherry juice.
And then we worked on, you know, using Dakota words next to the English words to describe what was on that plate. So that's been really a great tool.
She says kids will bring it home and put it on their refrigerator. But it goes beyond healthy eating. Stacey finds that when recommended improvements are culturally and traditionally relevant, there is a greater willingness to listen and learn.
We're trying to bring back our Dakota language, but we also need to revitalize our traditional foods.
Culturally appropriate teaching methods have helped integrate healthy changes at the Lower Sioux community. Stacey mentioned, however, that it is often difficult to access or purchase Indigenous foods due to availability or price. Some organizations have recognized this need and are pushing for Indigenous food revitalization. I'm Leah Lem.
Cultural revitalization is the mission of a unique school in northern Minnesota. It's a K-12 program administered by the White Earth Tribal Government, and it has a wellness plan that goes hand-in-hand with culture and academics. You'll hear more from Circle of Life later in the program. But for this story, reporter Lori Stern spoke to Murphy Thomas, an elder who is an Ojibwe specialist at the school. As you'll hear, Murphy also has a vital perspective on diabetes.
At Circle of Life Academy on the White Earth Reservation, everyone is Anishinaabe. You hear Ojibwe everywhere. Murphy Thomas is my guide. We're walking through the cafeteria at the Circle of Life School.
My status here is like an elder. It's called an elder traditional specialist or something. You know, I carry sacred items. You know, I have sacred items that were passed on to me or given to me by elders from different areas. I didn't want this responsibility, what was given to me. I didn't want it. But it kept coming back to me.
Murphy is tall and trim. He wears jeans, tennis shoes, and wire-rimmed glasses. He uses a walker to get around now. He was diagnosed with diabetes in 2005, shortly after the shooting at Red Lake that took 10 lives.
I don't know if I should blame that incident, because, you know, it was really a terrible thing that happened in our school.
Were you there?
I was there, yeah. I was there that day that it happened. And maybe about 4 or 5 months after that incident, I started feeling a change in my body. You know, things started feeling not right.
Murphy saw a doctor who told him his sugar and blood pressure were too high. Soon he was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, it's getting worse, yeah. You know, I've got that, what you call that, neuropathy on my legs and on my hands. And that's part of the reason why, you know, I have a hard time just sliding, when it's cold like this, just sliding a card in a door, turning my ignition on. See, like right now, you can see that they're swollen.
They're kind of dark and bumpy, huh?
Then, well, that's that arthritis. It
looks painful.
It's not painful. It's frustrating when I can't do things. Like I was telling you, you know, there's students here when they have to tie something or make something, and I try to help out, and it just gets frustrating. I can't follow through with that.
I first heard about Murphy from a researcher at the medical school at the University of Minnesota, Duluth.
Yeah, I'm Melissa Walls, and I'm Bois Fort and Kuching First Nation Ojibwe, and I'm an associate professor here at the University of Minnesota Medical School on the Duluth campus.
When Melissa was in graduate school, Murphy was one of her mentors. Now he's part of a diabetes study with her, a type of research called community-based participatory research.
During one of our meetings, we were talking about this variable in the study called medication adherence.
In other words, did diabetes patients take the medicine doctors prescribed for them? Melissa said she'd always been struck by the way Murphy chose his words, but especially this one time.
And Murphy really quieted the entire room when he spoke and said, you know, we're really putting this on the individual when there's something bigger going on here. They're not just not taking their medication because they're lazy or they don't want to or they don't understand it. Maybe they're actively deciding not to because they don't trust what that medication is. Why should they trust the government to give them another, you know, syringe or another pill? All of these years, Western science has told us, if you take this metformin, if you take this insulin, you're going to be okay. And look at us die. Look at us get amputated. Look at us suffering.
Murphy says his Western doctor in Fargo consults with Native elders, so Murphy's inclined to trust him. He says he takes insulin sometimes, but prefers Indian medicine.
I usually stick with my medicine men or medicine women. That's who I follow. And I think that's what's kept me going along for, you know, for this time.
Circle of Life Academy tries to teach students how to thrive in both Indian and non-Indian worlds. Some of the students keep traditional ways at home, but others have to work to reclaim their culture. Murphy helps with that, and the students honor him for it. For instance, today, it's lunchtime, and one young man has prepared a meal to share with Murphy.
Puggy Goodwin, one of our students, yeah.
Bonjour.
Deer meat, burger.
You got an extra one?
That's, well, yours is in the pan.
He's an excellent cook.
The small stove is in a large room with a bunch of tables. We watch a couple dozen students work on projects.
Right now, those students over there that are on the table, they're playing moccasin game. That's been handed down from generation to generation to family to family.
Ojibwe teacher Ryan Bajan is helping an eighth grader attach sheep bells to a dancing stick.
A lot of these guys are learning these skills for the first time, you know? So we call that Oshkabewis, you know, they're apprentice. They're a helper, apprentice. They're learning something that they're going to be able to pass on to other people.
And then sometimes we talk about, like, diabetes. And see, like, majority of these young men here, their parents, they either have diabetes or they're on the borderline. And we always try to tell them that, you know, to be overweight, that's one of the reasons why we have a lot of diabetes in our families.
Murphy grew up in Panema in Red Lake. He remembers when commodity food started to replace the fish and rice and lean meat his parents and grandparents were raised on. He tells me none of them had diabetes.
How slim they are, how muscular they were. Their hair, you know, teeth, everything. They aged good. They aged properly. When we started looking at easy way of living, you could say, you didn't have to walk out in the woods to go do your hunting. Didn't have to go out in the lake to pull your nets. You know, didn't go out to go check your traps. We started losing that gift that was given to us.
The students at Circle of Life Academy aren't the only ones learning from elders like Murphy. Professor Melissa Walls.
One of my guiding principles in doing research with tribes is that the first Americans have a lot to teach the rest of the world. If we can honor those voices and hear those voices, we're probably going to get better scientific answers.
Melissa works on fusing traditional wisdom with evidence-based research. And that's not so different from how Murphy has learned to cope with his disease.
Don't ignore it, except your diagnosis of diabetes. Don't let it control you. You control it. If you're borderline now, get on that bike. Get your walking shoes on. Do what you have to do to keep it on that line, that borderline.
I'm Laurie Stern.
As you just heard Murphy say, once you're diagnosed with diabetes, you can manage it, but you can't go back. A clinic in the heart of the Twin Cities Native community helps people figure out what to do no matter what their A1C is. A1C is a measurement that gives you a 3-month average of blood sugar levels. Reporter Cole Primo says awareness is the first step.
When I walk into the Native American Community Clinic on a cold but sunny February day, the waiting room is buzzing with patients and children playing. Around 85% of NAC's clients are Native, and NAC works directly with diabetes patients. I'm here for an interview with two members of NAC's staff. Camille Bonert is a registered nurse and a certified diabetes educator.
We screen basically anyone who walks in the door just because it's really prevalent in our patients, and we want to catch it early, and we are catching it really young.
Really young, yeah. Yep.
Mariah Johnson is the Health Promotions Program Supervisor and Registered Dietitian.
We do see the majority of the kids that diagnosed with prediabetes are actually like 10, 11, 12, 13, maybe a few 9-year-olds.
Johnson calls it the perfect storm.
It's exactly what you would expect, right? It's like this obvious stuff that we see everywhere. It's screen time, increased screen time. Obviously, lack of physical activity. Most of the kids that I talk to who are either overweight, obese, or maybe even pre-diabetic or with some lipid abnormalities, they oftentimes don't have PE in schools.
NAC works with various other programs like the YWCA, where these kids can get exercise and the help they need. After they fill out paperwork, people get screened. It's a common blood test used to give NAC a glimpse at how your body is handling its sugar.
It's an A1C, which is just a finger poke, and it gives you your average blood sugar over the last 3 months.
Mm-hmm. That's it?
Yep.
The higher your A1C level, the poorer your blood sugar control is, and the higher your risk of complications from diabetes. It's not a diagnosis, but it's a good start. But say a patient is screened and then diagnosed as a diabetic. What happens next? First, NAC tries not to hit them too hard with information, but lets them know the situation and helps answer their questions.
we get them back, like, right away. They're coming back to see us within a week. And then we might hit it a little harder and be like, okay, let's talk about this. I'm going to teach you what diabetes is. I'm going to teach you about the food. I'm going to teach you about everything.
Then an important next step is a referral to their diabetes class.
Which is weekly for 4 weeks, and we go over everything top to bottom, and it is more of a group setting, so it allows them to ask each other questions and talk about struggles that they've had and all of that. We do goal setting and all sorts of stuff. They get little incentives for each topic, like they get a portion plate to help them out with the meal planning. They get resistance bands to help them out with the physical activity. They get glucose tabs for those patients who are at risk of lows, and we talk about how to treat it. And
it's pretty thorough.
Yeah, everything.
They say one of the biggest challenges in dealing with diabetes is patients believing it's inevitable.
When they're pre-diabetic, they think it's inevitable. They're going to end up diabetic because their parents were, their grandparents were, their brother is, their aunts are.
It's almost just like this acceptance.
And so there's, it's like an acceptance and sort of just going along for the ride rather than taking the wheel and really steering the prevention efforts and reversing it.
NAC says most of its patients who end up diagnosed are overweight and carry their weight in their midsection, which is one of the biggest risk factors for heart disease and diabetes.
But of course you still get your cases of patients who are actually a healthy weight and they still end up being diabetic in their one strike that's a heavy strike as being native and maybe
having
over
the family
40,
history I would
and
say
and the family history as well.
NAC has to fight for funding. A grant from the CDC that paid for diabetes prevention classes ended last year.
With everything else in the world, things fall in and out of favor. And you started kind of seeing funding for diabetes prevention classes dwindle, but then other funding areas start to strengthen. So,
I asked them if opioid abuse and things like that were shifting focus.
And we were just having this conversation last week as well. And so not just diabetes prevention, but I would say chronic disease management and preventative care in general is kind of taking a little bit of a backseat. And we definitely feel that here in the clinic. And Camille can really speak to that working with that.
Yeah, the opiate epidemic is getting a lot of attention right now, which is good and which we are focusing a lot on it. But yeah, sometimes it makes other things take the backseat.
To end the interview, I was curious about what resources they'd have to fight diabetes if this was a perfect world. Here's Johnson.
You know, green space, even more green space. I feel like that's the thing I get told a lot is like, it's not, I have nowhere to go. It's not safe to walk outside.
As the nurse, my dream would be to have all of the medication free and available to everybody because everybody deserves it.
They say there are plenty of social issues that need to be resolved first.
We're like the end piece. All of those other things have to be in place.
Despite grant cuts, NAC strives on, screening as many people as they can. NAC does see many patients who take the pre-diabetes diagnosis as a wake-up call and really do change their lifestyle for the better. I'm Cole Primo.